Hello and welcome to Coffee House Shots, The Spectator's daily politics podcast. I'm Cindy Yu and I'm joined by Katie Bors and James Forsyth. So last night, the Brady Amendment passed, giving Theresa May the instructions to go back to Brussels to seek alternative arrangements on the backstop. But actually, the Cooper Amendment to seek an extension to Article 50 didn't pass. Katie, what's the aftermath of last night's votes?
So we had Tory unity last night to some degree. I mean, there were a handful of Conservative MPs that didn't vote for the Brady Amendment, but they were the usual suspects, so to speak. They were those people who want a second referendum or to put a plane to stay in the EU, and they're not about to come behind anything Theresa May could get back. But you had the European Research Group get behind Theresa May of Tory backbenchers, and you also had the DUP, and Nigel Dodds give a very supportive statement soon after they'd won that. So it's strange. I think there is definitely a boost in the Conservative Party this morning, and definitely people are feeling a little bit optimistic. They think that last night went better than actually most of them had imagined, because Cooper did not pass. It wasn't even that close to passing. I mean, it wasn't down to, you know, one or two votes. And the Brady Amendment fairly comfortably passed for Theresa May. That said, I think even the most optimistic Conservative MPs, in terms of the ones in government, are aware that Theresa May is being sent back to Brussels to ask for something, which is perhaps near impossible. So there's definitely relief that the party is united briefly around a position, but there is a realisation that this unity is not going to last that long.
And James, Theresa May is not going back to Brussels today, but will be very, very soon. I mean, is she going to get anything other than a no?
I mean, the question is, she's obviously not, as Katie said, she's not going to get everything. She's not, it's not like she's going to arrive in Brussels and Jean-Claude Juncker is going to say, the Maltese compromise, let's do it.
Why didn't you say so
the
before?
The question is, can she get something? Because what happened, if Theresa May is going to get her Brexit deal through, she needs to keep two things need to still be a live possibility. One is no deal, which it is because the Cooper Amendment failed. No deal is still possible. And it's also quite striking that even the Spelman declaratory motion against no deal only mustered a majority of 8, which is quite interesting, compared when you consider that Brady got a majority of 16. And on the other hand, she needs to keep alive the danger that, you know, the House of Commons doesn't like no deal, so it might delay Brexit or stop it entirely if that was no deal was a possibility. If May could then come back with something, she would then have a possibility of what you might call a kind of Rees-Mogg McCluskey strategy. She turns around to Tory Brexiteers and says, look, I've got you something on the backstop, and it's a legally binding change, and look, you can see that there's a majority in the Commons against no deal, so if you want Brexit, you've got to vote for this deal. And at the same time, she accepts that she's not going to get, as Katie said, the kind of Tory second referendum types to vote for it. And they're probably going to be a hardcore of ERG types of 15, 20 or so, who could almost wouldn't come on board regardless. And she hopes to make up for those numbers with Labour MPs who don't want either a second referendum or a general election fought on Brexit. And that's the kind of McCluskey wing of a strategy. That's why you see number 10s talking about workers' rights. That's one of the things that Theresa May immediately spoke about after the vote last night. Because she thinks if she can get some warm union words about a deal at some point, then that gives Labour MPs cover to vote for a Tory Prime Minister's Brexit deal.
I think one of the problems she has there was, I was speaking to someone who is involved with Unite, and I would say Lemma Cluskey's Unite is probably one of the unions more sympathetic to the idea of actually leaving, not having a second referendum, and ideally leaving the EU with a deal. But that union is so closely aligned to Jeremy Corbyn, Lemma Cluskey has made clear that his ideal scenario would be a general election as a way to break the deadlock, bring Jeremy Corbyn in. That I think their red line is basically this idea that Theresa May would need to pivot to a permanent customs union. That is Labour policy. And when you had Lem McCluskey go in for talks with Theresa May, I think that there are figures in Unite who basically thought that perhaps Jeremy Corbyn had made a strategic error by not going for talks the first time, because you could just go in, look like you're cooperating, but stick to your red lines. And I think that to get an endorsement from a union like Unite, they would want to see her pivot to the Labour position, because it is led by political people.
I think they're not talking about a full-on kind of Len McCluskey coming out and doing a full-on endorsement. I think they're talking about a kind of a lack of opposition, a kind of understanding of why Labour MPs might do this, and, you know, some protection within the Labour movement on things. I also think that there's interestingly, you see that Jeremy Corbyn has politically, I'm not talking about kind of, you know, morally or philosophically, but politically, Jeremy Corbyn has handled Brexit very well. He's managed to keep the kind of two bits of a Labour coalition going on in tandem. I mean, the one big mistake he's made was his failure by saying he wouldn't meet with Theresa May after she suffered that 230 vote defeat, because at that point she was at a very low ebb. He'd have been in a very powerful position, and also by his refusal to meet with her, he made it very easy for her to pivot back to her own party. She could say, "Well, I've tried this cross-party thing; hasn't worked." You know, now we know that they're meeting later on this afternoon, but you know, you can tell where the balance of power lies in the fact that they're meeting in Theresa May's Commons office. Mm-hmm. So Jeremy Corbyn isn't going to get any wonderful picture of him going through the front door of Number 10, looking like he's the person, you know, coming to the nation's aid in this hour of crisis. And I think that is a sign of a mistake Jeremy Corbyn made in not agreeing to speak to her after she suffered that 230 vote loss.
And Katie, yes, this is one of the big developments of last night, that Jeremy Corbyn finally agreed to talk to Theresa May. This is the moment that it happened.
Because since we've had this debate and the House has emphatically voted to reject the no-deal option that the Prime Minister was supporting, could I say that we are prepared to meet her, to put forward the points of view from the Labour Party.
So, Katie, are both parties just going through the motions here, or might something actually come from these talks?
I think few expect this to be an enjoyable coffee for either of the attendees, and I think few expect it to actually lead to much in the way of developments. I mean, sitting in the press gallery for Prime Minister's questions, it was a very spiky session. It was also quite dull because they didn't really move it forward, but there was no love lost on either side, and you were thinking, if this is, you know, 2 hours before you meet, how dry and awkward is this coffee going to be? And perhaps, you know, have tea or so forth. But this idea that they're going to go and have a, you know, progressive meeting where they move forward was just very different to what was happening in the chamber. And I think the problem is and why some people think Jeremy Corbyn made a strategic error by not going the first time, is he can make Theresa May's life quite difficult if ultimately, as James has touched on, Theresa May is going to need some Labour votes, and because we just don't expect this Brexiteer support to hold in its entirety, even if she does get a concession. But Jeremy Corbyn could make the price on getting a large chunk of Labour votes, something like a permanent customs union, and that's where Theresa May would be in a very difficult position. So I think that if he was going to make a move like that, that would be the type of price he was asking for. I think the other result of what happened last night was we saw Labour whip for the Yvette Cooper amendment to try and extend Article 50 if no deal looked likely. Yet they didn't, even with that, they didn't manage to get there. And I think that has made it even less likely, I don't think it was ever that likely, that Jeremy Corbyn is about to come out for a second referendum. You know, if he can't get his party to support the idea of even extending Article 50 for perhaps 3 months, which is what he was saying, I don't think he'd really move to do that for, you know, should we have a vote remain on the table. So it might be that now he, and part of the reason he said he will now talk to Theresa May, is his best bet is to say, we can work with you if you come around to our position. But even then, Brexit is incredibly uncomfortable for Jeremy Corbyn because his party is divided between people who are pro-EU and want to stay in and Leave voters who tend to vote for Labour and trying not to isolate them. So I think any decision he makes is as difficult as any decision Theresa May makes on the subject.
And James, the Cooper Amendment not passing, that was a surprise, wasn't it, to a lot of people, given that Jeremy Corbyn had already given front-bench Labour support to them. What happened there?
I think there were more Labour MPs who were not prepared to vote for it than expected, even with a whip on it. I think one of the other things as well that happened is Theresa May was quite effective in basically saying to people, look, don't worry, you'll get another chance to vote against no deal. This isn't the last chance saloon. But, and that's why various ministers didn't resign to vote for the Cooper Amendment. But things have changed for those ministers, because now that the House of Commons has said what it wants, those ministers have got to join in this kind of chorus of voices calling on the EU to show some flexibility. Having, if you do that, it'd be fairly odd to respond to that 2 weeks later by saying, well, the EU haven't shown any signs of flexibility, so I'm going to resign from the UK government in protest at that to vote against no deal. That's the problem they put themselves in, because the danger now is that, you know, that they might not see it like this, but in terms of British public opinion, the ball is now back in the EU's court. Parliament has said, replace the backstop with alternative arrangements and we'll vote for the withdrawal agreement. And so therefore, it makes it more difficult for those ministers threatening to resign, because it's easier to resign when it's the UK government that is perceived as being inflexible, rather than when it looks like it's the EU that have been inflexible.
James and Katie, thanks very much. And you are listening to Coffee House Shots. You can subscribe to this podcast on the iTunes Store or wherever you get your podcasts from. And do leave us a review. And today is the 30th of January, which means that it's less than 48 hours to go until the end, I repeat, the end of our John Lewis voucher. So if you want to get 12 issues of The Spectator for just £12 plus a free £20 John Lewis voucher, go to spectator.co.uk/voucher as soon as possible. Thanks for listening, and do join us again tomorrow.